Thank you, Honorable Chair and members of this committee. Just to start off with, perhaps just introduce myself. My name is Johan Theron. I'm the People Executive for Impala Platinum, also responsible for sustainability. Just on behalf of our CEO, Mr. David Brown, his sincere apologies. He would have loved to be here. Unfortunately, he's tied up in court proceedings. We've got a deadline in Zimbabwe to meet in November, and the board meetings have been set up in such a way that all those board clearances have to be secured, and he couldn't extract himself from that process, so please accept his apology. I think the advantage of that is with me, I've brought a team.
Are you saying to us that you are compliant with the Zimbabwean legislative requirement?
I'm saying that we're working our way through the maze to make sure that we find a way forward.
It's interesting. Are you giving them the 51% they're looking for?
I'm not at liberty to disclose because it's not been presented to our board, but in due course, the outcomes of the board meetings will be presented to both the Zimbabwean government and will be made public as well. I just feel a little bit cornered here, Honourable Chair, but it's okay, I understand. I think the advantage, if I could just introduce my team with me, the gentleman on the far right there with the deep radio voice is Dali Duma. He's the head at Impala responsible for all our community projects and housing and infrastructure. So he's very much the guy that heads it up and drives it and is well positioned to deliberate with this committee on those issues. The lady on my right is Dalian Sutter. She heads up procurement for the Implax Group. And again, he's very well positioned to deliberate and share with you the status as far as procurement is concerned. And the two ladies on my left here, the first one is Joanna Tau. She heads up at Impala all of our operational interactions with stakeholders, communities, government. So where we give effect to the mining charter, she's in fact the one that coordinates and drives that process. And Gwen Baum on her left-hand side looks after all our labor sending areas. So specifically in our case, we draw a large number of our workers from the Eastern Cape and from Taung in the north, Northern Cape. So those are very important areas to us and therefore the dedicated resource to make sure that we give due consideration there. Just with those few short words, if I can then just dive into the presentation. We have made available a handout on transformation and the mining charter elements. All of the detail are in there. You'd find even more detail in our annual sustainability report that was recently released in August. So what I'll do in the presentation, I think I'll focus on the key issues. And if we have to go into any sort of detail, it is available and we certainly can do that. All right, if I can start off then. Just to give you an idea of Impala or Implax, the company. We operate in two areas. We operate in Zimbabwe, which is at the top there. You'll see that long Great Dyke. There are two mining operations there in which we have a stake. The northern one close to Harare is the famous Zimplax, which is our largest operation in which we have a majority shareholding. The one a little bit lower down is Mimosa, which we have a JV with Aquarius Platinum. Much, much smaller than the Zimplax operation close to Harare. And that essentially is our operations outside of South Africa. Within South Africa, the heart or the majority of the business is concentrated in Rustenburg, in the sort of western limb of the Bushveld. It constitutes roughly 60% of our value generation is still situated in that business. So it's a very large and very important business for us. Because it's deep level underground mining, it's much more labor intensive than the Zimbabwean operations. So the percentage of employees and jobs would be much, much higher in relation because it's so labor intensive. Then we've got a small mine on the eastern limb of the Bushveld near Burgersfort called Marula Platinum. And I'll give a little bit more detail so that you just get an appreciation for that. But that essentially is the company. We employ 57,000 people. And just in terms of capital investment in the business, we've invested 37 billion rand in the last 10 years. And in our recently approved business plan, looking forward in the next 5 years, it is our intention to spend another 35 billion in the next 5 years. The majority of that, 29-odd billion of that, will be spent in our Rustenburg operations, where we are sinking three of the biggest underground shaft complexes in the world currently under construction, and that is meant to sustain and increase production from the Rustenburg operation. We're also studying and in the final stages of studying another shaft complex at our Leeuwkop prospect, and potentially there is a platinum mine there that could employ up to 5,000 people, but we just need to finalize the study, and we need to make sure that everything works out and take it to our board. We're hopeful that by February or so we'll be at the stage where we can have much more clarity on the future prospects of that operation. Just in terms of capital flow, just so that you also get a sense of the size of the business, in the last financial year, the business returned 2 billion rand in the form of taxes to the fiscus, another billion rand in the form of royalties, and 3 billion rand to the providers of capital, i.e. the shareholders and the banks which we have loans, so dividends and loans. So roughly a 6 billion return, and then a similar number spent on capital, another 6 billion reinvested in the company. So hopefully that gives you a little bit of an idea of the size of the business that we're talking about. Just in terms of where we're coming from, and to just give you a sort of a feel for the organization, we certainly view transformation at Impala more than legal compliance and or a numbers game. And I sincerely hope that our declaration here today would leave you with that impression. We certainly recognize unemployment and poverty as our greatest challenge in the organization. We've been certainly in Rustenburg in operation for more than 40 years, and we can't walk away from the history of the country and the history of mining in this country. 10 years ago, if I look just at our Rustenburg operation, roughly 60% of the workforce came from foreign neighboring countries. So only 40% of the jobs was South Africans working at our Rustenburg operation. Of that 40%, 80% came from labor-sending areas, so it was imported labor. And you can only imagine the social dismay that this kind of practice has on the social fiber around mines, and therefore the statement that, you know, transformation has to be more than legal compliance and numbers. We certainly accept our responsibility to solve problems of the country as well. I think the Chair has articulated that the mineral endowment belongs to the people of South Africa, and as a large company you only have custodianship of some of these assets. If we don't work hand in glove to also try and solve some of these problems, we wouldn't be doing the country any justice. To do this well, it's imperative that we sustain and grow our business, but I would also argue equally important that as a country we grow and as an industry we grow. Because in a growing environment, we just have so much more that we can do. Reflecting on some of the key issues in terms of the mining charter, starting with ownership, our shareholding structures, and I'll explain it in the subsequent slide in a lot more detail, is fully broad-based. Our model, our stated intention at each one of our operations, is to have a large community shareholding ownership component. Equally, where possible, we'd also like to empower our employees because they are an important contributor to the business. And then where possible, we also try to bring in BEE entrepreneurs, specifically black entrepreneurs. And having all three in the right ratio and the right caliber is crucial to the success of the business and the empowerment model in our view. Presently, empowerment at the Implats group level is at 26%, just slightly above that, which is the mining target for 2014, and again I will slice into more detail in the subsequent slide. And certainly we believe that we have one of the largest unencumbered empowerment stakes in mining in South Africa, and we're very proud of that. I would go as far as to say, because the heart of the operation is in Rustenburg, in an area that is known as the Bafokeng's land, and because we've mined there as guests of the Bafokeng over a number of years, I think we've, over the years, have built an appreciation of what it means to be guests at other people's pleasure, and we've had to get to grips with some of these elements of transformation a long time ago to be successful, and I think today that has put us in a very strong position. I think our experience out of the Rustenburg and working with the Bafokeng, and it wasn't always an easy relationship. It certainly has had its ups and downs. It's built with us an appreciation of that model, a model where real transformation, real ownership, real change has to happen. And if we go to the next slide, I think the reason why it's so important is mining is different, in my view, to other businesses in South Africa, in the sense that mining operations are located in a very specific area. It's not like a bank or a cell phone company where you distribute it over the whole of South Africa. So your impact is much more concentrated where you operate. And for that reason, if you look at the structure there, and let's just focus on the grey bars there, which is our mining operations. This is where our mining licenses are concentrated. You would see that we endeavor to empower at each one of those operational levels. So if I can just start at the top one, which is Implats, that's the Rustenburg operations on the Bafokeng land. That's 100% owned by Implats, the holding company at the top. That is 26% empowered. That empowerment was negotiated with the assistance of the DMR as the Bafokeng Nation and the workers of Impala in an ESOP. It was our intention to also list it and keep it at that level, but our partners have subsequently engaged with government and the DMR and asked that that shareholding at that level be extended at the company holding level, because they understood that mining, you mine out the property. And they could see that our investment in Zimbabwe, where a lot of mineral resources are, would probably be mined much longer down in the future. So it made sense for them to just move that empowerment at the Impala level to the holdings level, where it is a smaller percentage, but it's still equivalent to the 26% at Impala, and then maximize their own empowerment, makes it easier for them because it's listed on the JSE, to trade in those shares, to receive dividends, to share in the growth of the business in areas other than just the Rustenburg area, which looking back over the history of that transaction, has certainly served them very well. So the Royal Bafokeng Holdings, or the Royal Bafokeng Nation, is that component, and the ESOP, or the workers throughout the whole organization. At the Marula level, Marula is 73% owned by Implats. The 27% BEE stakeholding is 9% the communities in the Marula mining area. And there's not one community. On the area that we mine, there's several communities. So we've worked with those communities as an entity. There's a 9% BEE shareholding there for Tubatsi Platinum, which is local business entrepreneurs in the Limpopo area, and another 9% is Macau mining. The Leeuwkop prospect, which is still just a study at this stage, which we are advancing, and hopefully we will be able to develop a mine there. The model is 26% at this stage is the community. There are no other partners other than ourselves and the community involved, because it's still very early in that business, and should we decide to progress with that mine, it'll take 10 years to develop the mine before it starts producing returns. So I think the uniqueness of mining business as well is that it's large capital and it takes a long time in new projects before you start seeing the dividends out of the business. And then we've got a 45% shareholding in Two Rivers Platinum, and that is 55% owned by ARM, and they will be presenting later today, and I'm sure they will expand on that for your benefit. You will see the two orange blocks on the right there. which is the reason Mr. Brown's here and not here today. Those are our Zimbabwean operations and stakeholder things there. And you've alluded to our requirement to also empower that to some degree and to the satisfaction of the Zimbabwean government. Just in rough terms, because I've heard the question asked, the current market capitalization of the Implats groups, 120 billion rand, there or thereabouts today, the 26% would equate to 31.2 billion rands worth of value in these, in the hands of these empowerment partners. It excludes share ownership by investment companies and all of the others. If you look at the debt levels, at the Royal Bafokeng Holdings level, there's no debt. Essentially, in the employee share ownership program, there's also no debt. It's a process that runs over 10 years, and employees have the ability after 5 years, and 5 years have just passed, to sell 40% of the equity if they choose, or they can hold it for as long as they want to, and after another 5 years, they will be able to sell the rest. That whole transaction was facilitated by Impala, and there's no special finance. So you could consider that to be essentially debt-free at this stage. The Marula operation is where I think we have challenges, and I'd like to expand on that. The Leucop, there's no debt at this stage. The transaction was structured in such a way with our partners there that the first billion rand of project expenditure on that project would be free. There wouldn't be any duty on them to contribute anything in the first billion rand. But should this project now progress, it is going to need significant capital, and we will have to find a way to structure how we're going to go and assist and make sure that we don't put them at a disadvantage ultimately. And certainly my experience of these transactions is, if you deal with a profitable business, then it's much easier. If it's a marginal project, then potentially you could have problems down the line. And certainly, Two Rivers as well, there's no debt there. So that's why I said it's probably the largest unencumbered stake in the country. The Marula operation is a very small operation on the eastern limb of the Bushveld. It's been in operation now for more than 5 years. It was originally structured that for the three empowerment partners there, that Impala assisted with the financing. So in terms of setting up the transaction, there were some discounts given, there were some favorable financing terms given to our partners, and certainly in the initial stages of the project, the business made enough money so that it could declare a dividend and the partners could start repaying some of the debt. That unfortunately has been severely impacted by two events. The one being the global financial crisis, which is impacted quite severely on the profitability of the business. And secondly, the business in its own right in terms of productivity and the employees coming to terms with the challenges of mining hasn't progressed as what we've hoped. So operationally, they're also not doing well, which has meant that the business hasn't made money over the last 3 years. Our partners haven't been able to repay their debt, and we have had to come in and certainly pay the interest on that debt on their behalf. That debt currently stands at about 1.2 billion rand. And all of our focus, including with our partners, is to turn this business around. And we've taken some drastic steps to make sure we can return it to profitability and to an state of operation where it can repay its debt. Because, having 26% of the business and, there's no net value, it isn't real empowerment. I'll speak a little bit later about that problem and how we try to overcome that. But essentially, if you then take the 31.2 billion rand, the 26%, and you discount the 1.2 billion rand debt, then you're still sitting with a 30 billion rand sort of net positive position or value that has been created over the last couple of years. When we talk about community projects, Dali will specifically talk about a Marula Chrome project. Now, as much as it's difficult to empower equity for a very large mine, what we've done there is we've given some of our chrome entitlements, that is a byproduct of mining the PGMs there, to the communities. We've given 50% to the communities. We've helped them and to construct an extraction plant, and we've transferred the skills, and we are now operating that chrome extraction plant with the community. But they essentially run it. They are the majority owners. It is unencumbered. It is paid off. And it's already making money. It is making money to the tune in good months of up to 10 million rand profit. Now, they can use that money to repay their debt at the top level if they so wish. They can use that money to do whatever they want because it's their business, it's their money. And we have to do this because we have to find more innovative ways of empowering communities, because if the equity transaction at the top level is not working because there's fundamental issues with the business and or the economy, it can't be used as an excuse. Somehow we have to navigate and find innovative solutions. But I'll leave that to Dali in his section to explore a little bit more broadly. I hope that gives you a much clearer picture of the group, its size and its empowerment.
Can you repeat for us your PE partners in Impala and Marula?
The Impala partners are the two yellow blocks on the left there. It's the Royal Bafokeng Nation. And it is the employees of Impala and Marula, which is the ESOP, the employee share options. The 2.6% at the Impala Holdings level is the ESOP. Of course, if you bring it down to the Impala level where the mining license is held, it's a much larger percentage of Impala than it is of Implats, the holding company at top level, if that makes sense to you. And at Marula, it's Makal Mining, Mrs. Khadebe's company. It's Tubati Platinum, which is a group of business people from the Limpopo province, from that area specifically, and then it's the communities on the property that we mine. Sorry, Chair, does that answer your question? All right, moving on to employment equity, and there's a lot of detail here, and I'll try and focus on the key points. You know, as much as transformation is not a numbers game, and as much as we endeavor to push the boundaries and do as well as we can, I have to sensitize the committee that in terms of employment equity, this is perhaps relative to our peer group where we find it hardest to distinguish ourselves and to move in front of the pack, so to speak. There are many reasons for that, and hopefully some of them will come out of this presentation. But at a high level, what are we endeavoring to do at Impala through employment equity? Is not to go and buy black faces. Unlike some rugby teams in Pretoria where we operate, you can't come down to the Western Cape and buy coloured players and say that you are transforming rugby. It is our stated intention to look at our own employees, develop them and bring them through the ranks. Only where we can't do that, where there's a specific talent need or there's a specifically good reason, do we want to go outside and get talent from the outside. So that is certainly our stated intention. A key part of the process as well is our bursary and learnership programs, bringing youngsters into the organization. And you will see there that we have an internal target of 80% HDSAs and 40% women for these opportunities coming into the organization. We've just had a strategy session and have looked at that policy a little bit more coldly, and have asked ourselves the question, why can't those ratios reflect the demographics of South Africa? And in fact, we've made a decision that going forward, we want to make that our policy. Because as much as it's going to take time to reach national demographics at a higher level and through the organization, when it comes to youngsters coming out of the school system, there's no reason bringing them into the companies why it can't reflect that demographic already. And certainly it will go a long way specifically to address a very, very key issue for the industry, which is black females. And I think we are all struggling with that. I think a very large part, and it's not reflected in the numbers, is the culture of the organization, is whether the organization is really having and building the right culture for transformation. as far as employment equity is concerned. And then the comment that we are in a very, very competitive environment, and with legislative targets where everybody has to be at a certain percentage at a certain time. There certainly are some players in the industry when they fall behind that go out on a buying spree and try and solve their problem in that way, which then makes it more difficult for us. But that's okay. That's how the game needs to be played. All right, moving on and looking at some of the numbers. For Impala Platinum, which is the largest organization, we've showed their top management, senior management, middle management, junior management, and core and critical skills as at June 2011. I think a couple of just things to notice. The first thing is, as far as a management team, it's not a big team. You will see that if you combine top management and senior management, you only get about 100 managers. That's not by accident. That's the way Impala operates. Impala is not a fancy company with lots of titles and levels and lots of people. We try and keep things as simple. We try and empower our managers and give them broad portfolios, and we try and compete on doing a good job with limited input. So that certainly is a first take. The next slide has got more of the percentages, but we can come back to this. And you'll see there, if you concentrate on the FY 2011 column, we're currently at 26% as far as the top management is concerned. I think the mining charter target for this, for where we are today, it should have been 25, so we're there or thereabouts. For the other levels, we're at 40, 41, 54, and 70%. And certainly, I think we've come a long way, but if you look at the Nakoda light of day, we would have wished to do better here. And certainly if you compare us to the rest of the industry, it will reflect, I think, industry's position. We certainly haven't managed to outperform the larger industry in this regard, and perhaps it's an area where we need to redouble and come up with even more innovative solutions to these problems. The next slides reflect Marula. You'll see it's a much, much, much smaller operation relative to Rustenburg. The top management there is only 6 people. You'll also notice that the person that heads up that operation, because that percentage is zero, the one person there is a white male, so the percentage there is zero, but we've been in the process of grooming a black HCSA person to take over that operation, and we should complete that handover in the next 6 months or so, then it will be 100%. But again, it's one person, it's 100%. If he leaves us, we're back to square one. So I just caution the committee that as much as percentages and numbers are important, you also need to see them in light of the sample size that you're dealing with, certainly at the top of the organization. Our board for the Implat Holdings level group at this stage is 62% HDSA, and there's a fair amount, at least 50% women, but it's at the executive management level that I think industry and certainly Impala needs to work a little harder. If you look at the percentages for Marula, you will see the 0% that I've spoken about, and you will see that for the rest of it doesn't look too different to certainly to Impala Rustenburg. I would just go further to say that in Marula, because it's a very isolated operation in a very underdeveloped part of the country, specifically getting professional women there, which means they have to relocate, live quite far from the operation, do a lot of traveling, is very challenging. And we're certainly trying to work our way through that as well. Alrighty. If you look at an Implat level, that is the numbers for the total group. And if you look at the percentages, Dolly, if you can just go to the percentages. This is women now, very more specifically. So what we try to do here is to unpack women. Just go back to the women one, please, Dolly. You'll see that at the top of the organization, female representation is 6%. Remember, at our board, it's 50%. 13% for senior management, and then it starts ticking up to 15%. And at the lower levels of the organization, it's sort of 10%. Now, those percentages, specifically at the bottom end of the organization, was very low 5 years ago. So most of the progress, I would say, in the last 5 years or so have been made to bring women into the business, and certainly to a large degree we've done that. It's much more challenging for a very deep, labor-intensive, manual operation like ours compared to a mechanized mining environment where there are more drivers and that kind of occupations. But certainly from our perspective, we would have loved to have done a little bit better in women at the top jobs. But just, you know, again, if you look at senior management, where we're only 13% and there are 83 positions, 40% of that positions will be mining engineers, very experienced, qualified mining engineers. And when you go and look for qualified, experienced black female mining engineers in South Africa now, they're just not there, which makes it hard to get to the kind of percentages we aim for. But I think when you go to the university level and you go and look at the classes at university that are currently studying engineering, it's a completely different picture. But unfortunately, the message is that it's still going to be a couple of years before the whole industry and certainly ourselves will be able, especially black females in those kind of jobs, to show the kind of progress that we can be proud of as a country. If I can step over to skills development now, what we've shown there is over the last 5 years, the rand amount that we spend on skills, as well as that reflected as a percentage of our payroll. Now, you will notice that Impala has always spent a lot on skills development. We haven't needed any motivation to spend money on skills development. I think because we are a very deep, labor-intensive organization, the value that's created in our organization is done through people, and hence our core value addition component is people, and we've always invested quite heavily in there. Moving forward and dealing with some of the issues that the chair has reflected, especially around the youth and unemployment, we had to relook at our investment and our programs here and come to terms and say that, you know, even if we think we're doing well here, it's not good enough in the context of what's happening in South Africa. And you will see that we have invested more in recent times, and you will endeavor to do even more and make sure that we don't just train for our own needs, but also, as I've articulated, play a role in perhaps solving some of the issues that South Africa needs to deal with. If you go into a couple of those key initiatives under skills development, Dali, if you could just move on. That just gives you over the same period of time, and hopefully you can see how some of these numbers have ticked up. And the engineering learnerships, you'll see that it's gone up over the period of time. It's almost at 300 now. It's our intention to get it up to 300 odd level per year. You see training engineering learners, bursars, secondary school bursaries, exponential, and you'll see the total there. If I could just perhaps reflect on a couple of them just for context quickly. As far as bursaries are concerned, you'll see that it's gone up. It is our intention. We still need to find the budget for it, but we're working our way to about 100 a year. Now, that's not a big number. If I'm sure some of the companies that will come and present to you will show much larger numbers than that, but I'd like to believe that Impala does it slightly differently in the sense that what we find is, and when we go to universities, is the majority of the people that access bursaries and are sitting at university studying, specifically in engineering-related disciplines like we require, come out of private schools and formal Model C schools. So what we've done in part of our bursary program is to say a large percentage of that, we want to go to the poorest areas in our country, specifically where we source labor from, being the Eastern Cape and Taung area, and go and look for students that perhaps, due to their own circumstances, can't compete with these Model C schools and private schools where they go for a competitive bursary interview. And taking at least 30% of our bursaries and giving to these deserving youngsters. Now, managing them through university is a very, very arduous and hard process because they certainly enter that system at a disadvantage. And sometimes it feels like looking after those 30 is like looking after 300 strong students that you can just pay their fees and they'll pass and you don't have to worry about them. But it's the right thing because my experience is as much as companies are giving lots of bursaries, it's very competitive and it tends to go to the best deserving people, and we need to understand that the playing field in South Africa is not equal as it stands today. The other area that we focused on in recent times is the exponential or the learnerships, and you'll see it's gone up, it's more than doubled over the last 5 years, and we need to do some more work here. The other area that we're finding is that a lot of youngsters go to university and they go to technicon and they get qualifications, but they can't access the job market. So essentially what we try and do here is to bring them into the organization for a period of 18 months or 2 years and give them that practical experience without any guarantee of a future job. But then making sure that if we can't give them a job in that 2 year period, they could walk out and secure a job in the labor market. Our experience is that when you do a good job with these youngsters, that during their tenure and their training period, vacancies do become available because they are known, because they are appreciated, because they are close to the managers making the employment decisions. They're often at an advantage position, and most of them, in fact, secure positions with us, you know, in the year and a half, 2 year training period with us. And certainly, I think as industry, in South Africa, this is perhaps an area where all of us can do a little bit better. The secondary school versus, you'll see that has come down, but it's because we're changing the focus of that program. What we've done over years is we've looked for deserving students among our workforce, and we've tried to give bursaries to assist them in their secondary school, especially children with maths and science and are doing well in maths and science. But what we're finding is that a lot of our employees' children are not in Rustenburg. In fact, they're in the Eastern Cape and Taung and areas like that. So instead of perhaps focusing on the employees in Rustenburg who already have the benefit of some very, very good schools that they can access, is to go to these labor-sending areas and perhaps get these children at grade 8 or grade 9, if the family circumstances allow it, to bring them to Rustenburg, to put them into a better school, if you like, and to make sure that they do their last couple of years in a good school, get a good matric, and have a much better chance of accessing the job market. Unfortunately, it's more expensive, which means we possibly will not be able for the same budget to do as much as we've done of the sort of local children. But again, with time, hopefully we can convince our funders that, you know, we can access some more funds and also push that program up. So I think that sort of gives you a feeling of the numbers and the kind of initiatives that we're involved in as a company. As far as procurement is concerned, which is the next area, I'm going to hand over to Dalian on my right here, who heads up our procurement, and take a bit of a break and then perhaps allow her to just talk to you in terms of how we're doing in procurement.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, and all the members of the committee. The first slide I present is mainly the Rustenburg operations. It's an overview of the last 5 years. The slide represents a solid performance by the company over the last 5 years, and it's clearly indicated that our approach was a year-on-year continuous improvement, based on a continuous improvement basis. If I can elaborate on our last financial year, the very last block on the slide, we have spent 4.5 billion rand with BEE companies, which represent 55% of our total purchases being purchased from black companies. From the 4.5 billion rand, 1.7 billion was spent with local companies. Local in this case is Rustenburg and the 29 villages on the mine lease area in the Rustenburg operation. From the 1.7 billion rand, 482 million rand was spent with local community suppliers. We have 76 local community suppliers. 74% of them were well supported in financial year 11. And 19 of them have executive supplier rights to Impala, which means sustainable business. If we elaborate a little bit on the latest, on the current mining charter, the mining charter measures the company in three commodities: capital, services, consumables, the block on your right-hand bottom. If we look at capital, we have done well against the 2011 mining charter targets. We have exceeded all the mining charter targets, but that doesn't hold us back. As I said earlier, our strive in this company is to continuously improve. Further to that, just to end this slide, we are doing business with 772 suppliers, in this case supporting the 4.5 billion rand spent. And as a matter of interest, and I'm sure you all are familiar with this information, this e-supply is where BEE partners are holding a stake of 25.1% ownership in these companies. On the Marula side, as Joanna said, it's a very small business. We have spent 377 million rand in our last financial year with BEE suppliers. 48% of that spend is 48% of the total spend is being purchased from BEE suppliers. 137 million rand was purchased from local suppliers. If you look at the right block on the block at the bottom right, also we have exceeded and done well against our mining charter targets, and we also have exceeded all those targets. Overall, I think Impala as a procurement section, we are very proud on what we have achieved on procurement. We've done exceptionally well. We eat, sleep, and drink BEE to make us work not only for our company but also for our country. And we are never, based on the question one of the members asked earlier, do we do enough? Tough question. When is enough enough? All I can reply on that is I think we're doing more than our best, but there's always room for improvement.
Thanks, Lillian. Perhaps just to close that section off for the benefit of the members, I think one of the key issues going forward that's going to be a challenge for us and for the country is that I think we've done the easy bit. The rest of the spend there that we have our eye on, a lot of it is with big multinational companies like Sasol and other companies like that. Now, they operate under the DTI broad-based scorecard, and ownership is only one element of that. And if they don't breach the 25% threshold, we can't count them as empowerment spent. And as much as we sit with them and try and push them into that area because it makes sense to us and look for alternatives when they're not prepared to that, they operate in a different environment. And, you know, they try and do good work in a lot of areas, and certainly not just focus on the ownership. So for us to move to the 100% is going to be very, very difficult, because I think the broad-based scorecard have taken a large incentive away from these companies to continue pushing hard at the ownership level, and that will certainly impact on our ability to move on. Maybe just the second and last comment on procurement. As much as we said that we're doing well, and that we also not just focusing on BEE, but the small players that, you know, that live and work close to our operations, most people in these communities think that they are BEE suppliers. So there's no shortage of people at our front door asking for procurement opportunities. And as much as you tell them that, you know, we're working hard and we will certainly listen to everybody and try and help where we can, often it means we have to say to a current supplier that is already BEE to give somebody else the opportunity. So, you know, I think as you progress, it becomes harder and harder and harder. And we're certainly finding that we need to run faster and faster just to remain where we are as an organization in terms of procurement. Ari, perhaps I can just hand over to you to talk about the home ownership and the community projects. But maybe just as an introduction, you know, I have spoken about labor and where labor comes from traditionally in the mining industry. I would say that home ownership is the cornerstone of our strategy in terms of helping the communities and our own employees. And you will see, and I hope it comes out of the presentation, that we put it really at the forefront. Because whether it is safety, where you're expecting people to behave in a certain way at work, our experience informs us that if that individual lives with his family in decent accommodation, close to the workplace, and can greet his family in the morning, he's much more motivated to come home safely at the end of the day. The unfortunate part of the history of South Africa is when we started this process, and if we look back and we ask ourselves, how many of our employees live with their families in decent accommodation close to the workplace? Our findings was less than 5%. Therefore, the very, very strong focus on home ownership, creating wealth, incentivizing people to buy houses, incentivizing our employees to bring their families with them and live with their families, because not only does it create wealth, economics have also taught us that if you own your own property, over a period of time with inflation, you create wealth in your own right. So if you want to one day retire, you need to have title deed to a proper accommodation. So it is a very, very strong focus and the cornerstone of our focus. The program also gives opportunities in that in the build program of building these houses, you can go and stimulate the broader economy of South Africa. You can bring other BEE construction companies into play. So it opens a whole bunch of other opportunities, if you like, that becomes possible. But let me hand over to Dolly to take you through that.
Okay. Thanks, Johan. Basically, what I'm going to deal with, it's living conditions and accommodation, but also community development projects, as Johan has said. I'm responsible for the Implats Group, at Implats Group for the sustainable development, whether it's on the side of the subsidiaries or the wholly owned companies. In terms of our forecast, which also was included in our social labor plan, it was to convert the hostels into real residential areas where you have got one man per room. But also what was highlighted there, it was the issue that the companies should facilitate home ownership, that people should own houses, which we find it very important as a company. And we remain and say thankful to the things like the SLP, because it made most of us being aware of what is the right thing. So what happened in terms of Implats Group, I'll start with Rustenburg. We started this project in 2007 around May when the strategy was approved by the board. And we set aside an amount of 2 billion sort of to concentrate on these. And you will see as I go down with the figures on the other slides that really we have worked on this. I would have loved to put more pictures, but I was warned that the time is only 20 minutes. And to me, what talks to me, because it's an area I'm passionate about, it's more pictures than the numbers themselves. The pictures which you are looking at currently, those were the first owners of the houses which we had there. And you would see people buying these houses from being organized labor, the first guy. It was through our strategy, because when we got involved into this project of home ownership, we involved the labor, we involved the municipality, and say, what would you like to see? From the land, that they pick up the land, to the design of the house, they pick up the design, we ask them, will this be suitable? And they said, yes. Then, this is what we have delivered. Up to so far, we have got 1,500 houses from May 2007 until now, which are occupied by the people as home ownership. Let's just basically take a look at the figures. If you look at conversion and de-densification of the hostels, currently we are looking at that number of 5,500. The amount which we allocated there, it was 396 million. And to the committee, I would be saying basically, I'm glad to say, when 2014 arrived, we would have relaxed for another 2 years. So if you want to see how they have been converted, the beauty of the conversion, you need to come soon. That's what we are saying. Because if you come in 2014, they would be 2 years old. And we would be finished, basically, with that. And we'll be accommodating 5,500 individuals in their own rooms. As I'm talking currently, we have got about 2,600 people, one man per room. So we are just doing the last wrap-up in terms of that project, which I expect it to be finished soon within this financial year. But also I have to put a qualification that knowing that it's DMR behind me to say they must not hold me to June next year. It is 2014. the single quarters, you would see 185 rooms there. It's basically the bachelor flats. What we have realized is that in reality, sometimes you have to separate the graduates who have just graduated in terms of allocation when it comes to company houses from the old generation like myself, because the behaviors tend to be different. Sometimes they would like to swim naked, and I wouldn't like that when my kids are around. So that's the accommodation which really we have provided. We have provided for the graduates from universities. The promotion of home ownership. After we have built the 1,500 units, there was still an appetite for the employees who said to us, guys, where is the houses? We need houses. Why it was appealing to the employees? I'll just give you a structure. The third bedroom house, it was 265,000, everything including transfer fees, nothing it says how the employee. 75,000 of that, it was a soft loan paid by the company, meaning he will not have any interest on that soft loan. So you see it with about 190,000. Then I've looked on the other side, which was not easy, I have to emphasize, which was the Department of Human Settlement. I said, I know you're dealing with subsidies for the first-time homeowners. Where is the money? Yes, it took me some years, but I'm glad to say I did get 3.3 million out of them. And that, if you take again, out of 190 and take out 35,000, which the employee doesn't pay, it works up to a minimum. I've said to people, on the third bedroom, a guy would pay 1,500. Inclusive. The only thing is not inclusive is rent and taxes and his household goods insurance. But everything is there. On a two-bedroom unit, he would pay 1,000 rent at the bond, a repayment. I've said, if somebody cannot pay 1,100 rent when he's working, then that person doesn't deserve to have a home. So that was the structure. And on top of that, we have gone to the banks and put the banks on the corner in terms of their responsibilities and all those, and negotiated for prime minus the amount which I would even debt myself if I go to the bank. They said I should not disclose the amount at all. But it was quite a huge discount from the prime rate. And we said, look, you take the bulk of employees from Impala, and this is the interest which you would like on our employees. And they were willing to take that note. So at the end of the day, those houses became affordable to the people. And I can say it's a quality home. Everybody who drives around Rustenburg, see those units, see the township development with infrastructure underground, tarred roads, paved pathways, and all those things. It's quite a good product. And also, I'm glad to say that after 2.5 years when I've signed the MOU with the Department of Education to build a school around that area, finally on Friday we reached the agreement that will build a 70 million school in that, starting as early as next year. And what happened also in terms of our critical employees, critical skills and all, we have realized that in Rustenburg there is a shortage of houses, so it becomes difficult for people when they come in to get the houses or rent the houses. We have constructed around 800 new units, as you have seen, the budget amount of 520 million. And the upgrading of the existing portfolio, so we have changed them from being minor houses with wire mesh fences and all to be really proper homes. And we had what we call Rustenburg North and East, which is the area where We are doing a lot of improvement for Rustenburg local municipality because other people have decided, or other companies, to demolish the units which were there because the area was really going down. We said we will upgrade the area and to make it live because the employees like it if the environment has been improved because of their access basically to the services around town. So if you look on the north now, we go to Marula Platinum. There we have procured the land, I think it's 225 hectares. Let me just see if it's my next slide now. It's 225 hectares. So the challenge which we are having there, as Johan have explained, is in terms of the mine, the survival. But not only that, because we are ready to build, there's no bulk services. And you cannot get any answer of when would you have the bulk services in that area. In terms specifically of water, that becomes the challenge within the area. If we are looking at basically the figures on what we have spent as a company, if you take the income generating projects and you would say up to so far we have spent 26 million, and then on housing it's 1.4 billion. That's Impala Platinum, which means it's basically a rusting deck. And the infrastructure is 22 million. It's basically your roads, your infrastructure, the libraries, the clinics, and then housing, that's the portfolio which I've just passed. On income generating projects, what we have done there, in reality, it becomes a challenge. I've heard the question being asked by one of the committee members who said to the previous guys who are sitting here, you then tell us what you mean when they say the challenge. Impala, basically, what I proposed, it was to say, let's change the focus. Let's try to concentrate on things which will benefit more people as compared to individuals. Because the challenge there, you go and open, for example, a bakery, then it's the fight about who's going to own it and all those things. Or you find it's six people, then the whole community is up in arms. But if you put a road, you put a clinic, you put a school, which are the key in terms of the report I've seen from the NPC, then you have got much better value. Just to highlight, we opened a bakery which is still sustainable in 2009 in the area called Rivilo, and we passed down because the labor sending area. It is still operational. The ladies, the difference there, we found people were intrapreneurs. We are running that for ages, but they were earning about 200 rand per month from what they were doing. So we just made it completely different. We got a franchise to put it in, but after that we chased away the franchise, then they are on their own. If you look in Rustenburg, basically we had the project of turning the sewage sludge and our wood chips waste into fertilizer. And then on the Eastern Cape we have got an essential oils project which is just next to the airport. When you land at Amtata, you usually fly over it. And we had a sort of a lot of initiatives. If you look at Rustenburg, the farming, for example, in terms of vegetables, which have not been so successful, that things, because you need skill and management on those without the personal interference from the beneficiaries. At Marula, we have spent 43 million, and the biggest spend there, as Johan have said, it was basically the chrome project, which we have said it was really a milestone. As we have seen probably about 2 weeks ago, our CEO, David Brown, in front of the business day when they said he's leading the pack, it was based on corporate social investment. That project is a project which was started a year ago, but to yield dividends on the first year of about 10 million, it's very rare that you get those type of projects. And how the structure worked, it was basically, you would find that the community was given for free the 50% shareholding, looking at the, and then Marula Platinum, which is in Pegasus area, said with 20%, because the Implats group funded the whole infrastructure of the thing without a penny. They said, okay, we'll take 30% of the dividends when there is dividends. But the Marula portion of the dividends, which is 20%, will go back to the community, meaning the 70% of the dividends you get out of that project, they are plowed back through the community using the community development agency, which has been set up by the community. We had other projects like the brick making, which are really successful in business, and we have seen it, but the issue is about basically the management. Once you remove the manager there, which you have got from our side, then things little bit turn around. And I've mentioned the land which we have purchased in those areas. And then in terms of the infrastructure there, we have recently built and renovated two high schools, which were basically built within that four farms area. And one of the key things which sort of, which was close to my heart, when I arrived at these schools, the first thing I would like to see is the administration building for the teachers, because I believe if they are not in the right mind, the classes can be as nice as they are. But if they cannot do their planning in an environment where they are comfortable with, you will never be able to get the results. We establish extra classrooms, the halls, the administration blocks, with full sort of services, your electricity, water, all those things. And then also we have done the roads, basically, within that area. So that's where the basic lot of infrastructure amount have gone to. Just in terms of closing, as I've highlighted that this year it was the second time that Implats have been honored by Sunday Times in terms of their run, which they have on a yearly basis, in terms of which company on the top 100 JSE-listed companies it's performing well in terms of corporate social investment. And in this year, within this year again, we have got that award. It was 2010, 2011, and the development which you see there on the left-hand side at the bottom is the development which I was talking about, which is Sunrise U, which we have done in the integrated community. We didn't put them separate as mine employees. And the extraordinary thing which we have done there, we said, we are not going to let only our employees buy there. We put about 100 units to the public. And we said, here's a unit, you can mix with our people. But the issue which also we have done is that we sold to our employees for 265. When we sold to the public, we sell them at 380. And the public, sort of, our employees have seen that there is value. There is about, let's say, you sit with 65% equity immediately when you buy your property. And also, that made sort of them happy knowing that they can sell the house at 360, where there are no conditions attached, which says you will remain for Impala for 8 years. Before then, you can leave Impala. At the top, on my right, you would see it's basically the chrome plant during construction at Marula, which is Pegasport. And I said, in these times, in an area like Kukuni, which is really poverty stricken, for a company like Marula, which is not financially well, to spend about 38 million on social projects, it's quite a good figure to me. At the bottom, what you see there is the geranium from the essential oils, which basically becomes Gwen's baby when he looks after that. And those projects have been well accepted by the community. So basically, that's all what I would like to give from my side. As I'm saying, I'm a little bit disappointed because I couldn't show you the pictures in terms of the hostel conversions, the houses exactly then you would have.
Chair, I'm wrapping up and then I've got one slide just on some thoughts on job creation. I think as much as my colleagues here, you know, enthusiastic, and I hope it comes over that, you know, they think they are doing some good things, there are challenges, but I need to acknowledge that it's a partnership. What we've communicated to you today would not be possible without all the partners. You know, you've got the DMR who keep us honest and hold our feet to the fire. You've got the National Union of Mine Workers who are an integral part of the thought process and the value and making sure we deliver value. There's our board who have to approve the funding and the philosophy of trying to make a difference in South Africa. And there's local government and the provincial government. All of these projects and programs have to happen in a broader integrated plan, and without their assistance and guidance, it certainly is not possible. In terms of the benefits, I think in ownership we've done really well, and we would like to grow that in time. In terms of employment equity, I think as a company we can do better. I think the industry can do better. Specifically, black women come to mind, and we need to find solutions in that regard. In terms of skills, Impala will continue to over-invest in skills. It's the future of our country. A cornerstone of our community development is home ownership and making sure we right some of the social problems that we still sit with as a country and as an industry. And specifically, I think the success that we've had at Marula with the chrome plant have opened our eyes to the potential that these type of projects have, where you've essentially donated a right to the offtake of a waste product that can be benefited to a community, and because it is so much lower in capital efficiency, you can generate real wealth from in a very short period of time. So they don't have to wait 20 years for their debts are paid before they get real benefits out of their shareholding in the mine. And we are working on more projects like this. We're looking at, can we do something like this in Rustenburg? Are there other opportunities? And I don't want to make promises, but we are quite far advanced in our thinking of some of these things. And as much as we're trying to give you a picture here, it's very hard. Please come and visit us. It's much easier to share the real impact if you have your feet on the ground. And then just in terms of jobs and training, you know, very much in the mining industry, the question of unemployed youth is a taxing question to us. We've initiated a program in Rustenburg where we take novices and put them through our mining school and give them the mining skills to access the job market. That program has been running for 8 months now. We've given 389 people the opportunity. Most of them we've been able to employ ourselves. Some of them have gone to our competitors and contractors. But we are working on a much larger size of this project, and we're hoping that soon we'd be able to take 140 youngsters a month and put them through this program. That's roughly 1,500 new jobs or access to the job market per year. We're taking a little bit of a bet that Leucop is going to go ahead and that our shafts are going to progress and we're going to need some of that labor. But equally, if they go to our competitors, so be it. The country needs it. We're looking at whether we can take our artisan program and double it, and we're talking to some partners in that regard. We're looking at internships and how we can double that. So be assured that we are thinking about these challenges as you are and trying to find ways of making a meaningful impact in terms of specifically unemployed youth in the areas in which we operate. It is a time bomb, as you've articulated it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, the presenters have taken and exhausted the entire hour, misunderstanding that it was meant for both presentation and engagement. But I think let's then engage with their input. Over to you. Honourable Njobo, Honourable Kululu, Honourable Schmidt, Honourable Bigani.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm just three questions. One, are 67 employees are permanent, all of them? Number two, I want to clarify on skills development, secondary school bursaries. In 2007, the students were 267. This year it's 155. Lastly, kule issue le ye houses. If is subsidy or buyer rent, because if they pay the long savings, bazo kono afford that 1,000 and some change, man. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Honorable Khulul.
Thank you very much, Chair, for the presentation. I think this presentation was very elaborate, if I may put it that way. And I like rating these presentations. I'll give you 9 out of 10 for that. Yeah. It's not bad at all. I'm sorry, I like rating these things. And then I've got a few questions and a comment here, Chair. The first one actually will be the comment that I'll make. It's on the first presentation, whereby you're talking about the previous group. They were talking about beyond compliance. So they are talking about legal compliance. So I just wanted to get the sense as to what is the difference between the two. That's a comment in any way. And then the first question would be on the employment equity. In that I've seen your employment equity, it's not so bad, except to say that I did not see anything that you're doing pertaining to the disabled persons. There is nothing there, actually. I think you need to start doing something about that. I know you've got a lot of disabled persons in your area of operation, and you need also to accommodate them. That would be the first one, Chair. And I want to congratulate them on their Sunday Times Leadership Award that you won. I think that is on your CSR, isn't it? I think that one, I'll give you a star on that one. And then the second question also will be on the ownership. I was happy to see those pictures. I know you wanted to bring more pictures, but when I saw those pictures, I saw one person that I know. Is it from Mpumalanga? Those pictures. Oh yeah. Okay, I recognize some faces there. Yeah. And then the last question, Chair, it's on the on the houses themselves. In that, you see, if you give these people these houses, I just wanted to check when somebody, for instance, loses employment, what happens actually thereof? Do these people vacate the houses? What is the arrangement thereof? Let me pause there for a moment. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe it's opportune to ask of you, being the Human Resources Executive, but I've always tried to understand why ESOPs, which in my view should play a much stronger role in empowerment, always has the smallest percentage. It's always 2% or 2.6% but it's always the minor percentage, less than community trust, which I can understand. But what I can't understand is certain empowered individuals or businesses being empowered, re-empowered, and once again being re-empowered to the extent, at the cost, in my view, of community trust and ESOPs. And I'm still waiting for an answer some week to say, but ESOPs plays a lesser importance in terms of, trying to do away with poverty and the Gini coefficient. Why ESOPs always play? Is it a financial consideration? Is it a labor union consideration? Was labor unions opposed to the idea? Is labor unions acceptable to the idea? But why, when you have 60,000 employees, or sorry, 60,000 I think it was, or 67, why the best way to empower people would be to say to 67,000 people, instead of 2.7%, multiplied by 2 or 3, what are the arguments against it? Is it gearing? Is it financial? Because you would, from the human resource, kind of department, know exactly, you know, what the issues would be. Then secondly, the Roy Buffett King Nation example is an excellent example. But my belief is if the Roy Buffett King Nation could do it, any other community can do it. There is no excuse, there's no reason why not. It's as simple as that. If that community could get themselves organized, geared to the extent they have, with the assistance they have, many other communities can do so. And we should rather look at reasons for doing so than excuses for not doing so. And, you know, and I take your what you said in that regard. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Dugan.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine is not much, but I think I'm also tempted to rate. My colleague has been rating, but I'd rather not do so. But Chair, I must clearly indicate that there is evidence of some form of transformation and change for the better. And it's encouraging, especially in terms of the laws that we put into place to say that the changes that we want to see being brought about are actually working, and it's evident that we can get somewhere if more of your type of companies could actually be of assistance to other fellow companies in terms of them also following the relevant transformation processes, because it just makes everybody's life easier. And it's quite evident that in terms of your financial spends, where it's relevant in projects and so on, it doesn't disturb the fact that when you make profits, you still continue to benefit out of that. But hopefully you'll also then be able to move on to a wing where you are able to bring up more new members of the community to ensure that you are actually spreading your wings in increasing development around your plans. But the one area I'd like to ask a question about, I see you are talking about something like discretionary procurement expenditure. Can you just shortly explain to me what is the difference between your procurement expenditure and your discretionary funding? Where does it come from? And what's the difference? What does it entail having it as discretionary as of compared to straight procurement expenditure? And then in terms of your Marula plant, I think you also indicated that you seem to be having more difficulties in the Marula plant when it comes to procurement. Can you indicate these challenges and what strategies do you have in place to try and improve that, just to give an indication that you are able to resolve the issue? In honesty, Chair, I would now really be asking for blood out of a rock if I had to have more to say. But I truly do compliment them.
Much, Honorable Sondo.
Thank you, Chairperson. I came in the middle of the presentation, but one is encouraged by the boldness of the presenters who are saying, if you can't see what is in the paper, come and see it with a naked eye. That's very, very encouraging. You never heard that from previous presenters. But let me throw one complex and controversial one, and DMR is not absolved from this one. You are extracting labor from far-flung areas. you take these people into mining areas where you house them, others would tell you, we don't need houses. We want to go back home. What is the problem at home is that they want to plow their fields. Why would you not put the challenge to land affairs in areas where you have drawn out labor? You buy two or three tractors. You create there Yes, you create an entity like a cooperative there, where families of people who are working in the mines do benefit in the absence of the money that they always wait waiting for when utata ebuya emsebenzini. I mean, we've got dedicated women there who can till and plow the land. Why don't you just throw the invitation to either GMR or Land Affairs? That is one. The second one is that you mentioned in your employment equity that you are not only local, you import skills as well. That's not a bad idea. But it's an indication that we don't have those skills. I'm looking at a nice way of putting it. If you import five rare and critical skills into your company, into the country, into your company, do you develop those skills that you do not have? Because it practically means that you do not have those skills. What if I'm from Portugal? I came with my skill, I just decided to go. It means that you've lost that skill. Do you replicate those skills? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Yes. I think we have been lamenting on the area of details, and you were able to provide us with those details without us probing. Your record in terms of the investment in the country and your future investment is impressive as well. Your slides are not numbered, but there's a slide heading of our transformation imperatives, where you basically make reference to your transformation initiatives and so forth. On point three, you are discussing the skills development, the jobs creation, and then you talk of wealth, you say normalization. Okay, can you discuss that with us? When you say wealth and then in bracket, normalization, so that we don't attach our own interpretation onto that. And indeed, in terms of the empowerment or ownership patterns, I want to join the Honorable Member on the issue of the low percentage for the ESOP, the 2.6% at a group level, and the fact that you have indicated that you are working on strategies to be compliant at a group level, but you didn't give us time frames as to by when are you looking at attaining the required 26%. Are you looking at 2014 as the targeted time period, or would you want to do that before that time period, as you have done on the island? And because we're running short of time, some of the information you've given us we will have to analyze. But on your employment equity slide, I don't know what page is that. For instance, on employment equity, Marula Platinum, June 2011. On top management, you've got one white male, but in your grand total, I don't know what's the meaning of that bracketed B, whether it's black. So if it is black, it's misleading, because here in your more detailed area, you're giving us numbers that are concerning. But also the other worrisome area is on the slide which deals with women representation in implants. You seem to be falling in the same trap that DMR has picked up and reported on, which was confirmed by labor movement and other presenters. When we look at the column, you are discussing female representation here, but when we look at the column of white female, you've made quite a serious movement there. In top management, yes, you're on equal basis. You've got one African, you've got one white. But in senior management, you've got, five white female managers. Middle management, a whopping 22. Junior management, a whopping 52, which is what we have seen happening, that industry had a tendency of implementing the transformation on historically disadvantaged people. They would then target white women and then showcase to DMR that yes, indeed, we are compliant. Meanwhile, the issue, as we are all aware, that there was no law that was precluding white women in occupying these positions or being employed in the mining industry. We would want your reaction to that, as to why is this the case? Was it deliberate on your part, or was it coincidental? The last area is on housing. You know, you've mentioned that in the Siesta single quarters, you've set that aside for graduates. And you also were upgrading 849 units for rental stock. Mining industry is known to be notorious in segregating people, even when it comes to accommodation, which is one of the factors that contributed to the battles that were waged. For instance, there were certain blocks that were reserved for ethnic groupings, like this block is for Basotho, this block is for the Zulus, this block is for Xhosa, and so forth. And here again, when you are transforming, you are falling back into that trap of segregating. You're creating a class, different class. Here you're saying you're targeting graduates, and somewhere you're saying you're targeting the skilled employees. Why is that so? Accommodation is accommodation. Why is this necessary that you differentiate, among these people? Because you're setting them against each other. It's not a healthy competition given the history of the mining industry. And this kind of a situation is something that we thought that mining industry has moved away from in terms of segregating your people in this fashion. Yes, of course, in terms of affordability levels, you can talk about that, but to go into categories of skilled graduates and all of that is basically taking us back to that kind of a situation. And indeed, your future projects are quite impressive, as the other honourable members have indicated. Future job creation possibilities. You are not doing quite well. Remember the picture we have painted. Remember the national objective of the creation of 5 million jobs within a given period. And if our contribution is just going to be in hundreds, it doesn't make a serious impact to that national objective that was set by government. It's not set out of a target that has been thumbs up. It is set out of a desperate situation of the high levels of unemployment. Hence, we expect that the mining industry should play its pivotal part and role in that. Would you care to respond to those?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try and answer them in the order in which it was asked. The 57,000 people is 40,000 people that's employed and paid through our payroll. 17,000 is contractors. Of that 17,000, they are permanent contractors. In other words, certain services like the installation of equipment, certain development, specialized mining, we use what we call permanent contractors. But we disclose them and we treat them like our own employees. The fact that they are reported slightly differently, and in our annual report we make that distinction. So it's 40,000 people that's directly employed by us and 17,000 contractor employees. But these are permanent contractors. You'll still find them there next year and the year after that. Obviously, as a company, we are continuously looking at the kind of activities where we specialize and where we employ people permanently, and certain areas where contractors are used, especially in the debate around labor brokers. And let me just stress that these are not labor broker kind of employees. Especially as well in the context of safety and the requirements on working safely. It's our experience that it is better to have people in your own employment as much as possible, because it's easier for them to identify with the ethos of the company, to work in the kind of way you want to. So it is certainly a moving target and something that we're constantly looking at and saying, which of these groups of workers and specialized services can we make core activities of the organization and do competitively, because it will have benefits in harmonizing the workforce, in making sure that the safety messages and all of these things move in a certain direction. And we share some of the thoughts around our union brothers in terms of that. I'm not saying that contractors exploit their workers, but certainly my experience is that there are more loopholes and more potential issues that can come to the fore. So, you know, it's something that we're constantly looking at. In terms of the secondary school bursaries, you've correctly seen that it's gone down from almost 300 to 150. As I've explained, what we've done there is we've changed the focus. So instead of giving somebody assistance in a local Rustenburg school, we're now looking at bringing these children from afar and are putting them in a hostel and looking at them over a longer period of time, which is much, much more expensive and means that for the same money we can accommodate fewer children. But I think it's children that are more desperately in need of assistance, and it's just a matter of securing more funding in the future to get those numbers up again. Certainly it's our intention to get them up again. Dali, could you answer the question about the housing? I'll leave the housing questions at last then for you, okay. The point about disabled people is very well made. I just need to highlight to the committee that the mining industry is regulated by some very clear instructions in terms of physical capability for certain jobs, and certain people need to be of a certain ink to be able to do these jobs, and we can't put people in those jobs unless they're physically capable to do those jobs, which means that a large percentage of our jobs on the mine would be very difficult to put people with some disabilities in those jobs. But there are opportunities. There are a lot of opportunities on surface and in other areas, and we are continuously looking at this. And I think as a society, disabled people are more at a disadvantage than the rest, and we need to see what we can do, and certainly an area that we can have a look at and see if we can do better. On ownership, I think the Bafokeng model has worked well for us. I think when you get to the stage where a partner has paid off its debt, it means the money they're making out of the business doesn't have to go back in servicing the debt. They are our shareholders, so it's hard to speak on their behalf, but I know that they are spending in the order of 800 million rand a year back into their communities, which is money they would have used to service their debt if they weren't empowered. So certainly the model, I think, the model stands out. On ESOPs, it's a very interesting observation. If you take our 2.6% down to the Impala level where it's effective, it's 4%. So at the Impala level, it's a much higher percentage. The question as to why you don't see more and larger percentages, I think it's because it sort of emerged quite late in the process as an empowerment mechanism. And I think there is still a debate that needs to be resolved between the unions and the employers, because the model does bring some complexity with it in terms of some members of unions feel that it could align workers too strong with the employer and not with the union association. And then there are ESOPs and ESOPs, different models. And it's clear that perhaps in that debate we can reflect on which models have worked well and which haven't worked well, because there are fundamental differences in these ESOPs, and try and find a mechanism that works for both parties and that both parties would be encouraged to invest more heavily in. So perhaps still a debate that's open and needs to be resolved between the different partners. I think... Can I ask you to answer the question on the discretionary expenditure?
Discretionary expenditure excludes spend such as water, power, tuition fees. It's spend that we have control over, where we have the discretion to buy from more than one company. Water, electric power, parasitical companies, tuition fees.
Tali, perhaps in answering the housing, you can also reflect on the cooperatives and giving us assistance in those. Certainly the question on importing skills is a valid question, and I think it would be wrong of a company, when you import a skill that you need, in part of that process, not to make sure that you impart that skill on people that are in the organization, so that you depend and you remain reliant on that skill. So certainly a very strong part of our strategy, when we have to bring in skills in this way, is to put mechanisms in place to ensure that that knowledge is retained, and mechanisms are in place so that you don't end up having to import these skills all the time. That certainly wouldn't be sustainable. Chair, I can talk a long time about the normalization, but perhaps just in summary, I think it's an important debate. It certainly reflects on multiple levels. It reflects on, if you look at the ownership structures of capital in our country, it's distorted, and we know why it's distorted, and a key part of this legislation and of our efforts is to change that over a period of time and to normalize it to something that perhaps better reflects society and the interests of society. So at a high level, it's certainly that. At a lower level, I think it's also fair to say that there are jobs and jobs. There are jobs that have much more earning potential and jobs that create more wealth over a period of time. And these jobs historically have been in a very narrow group of people's hands. So normalization of wealth also has to do with ensuring that the broader society is better reflected in terms of management structures and occupying these jobs. And I would also go as far as to say that traditionally mine workers have not been homeowners. They traditionally come from rural areas where they've got access to land, they've got a house, they've got a field that they can plow, but they don't have a deed to that land. And without deed to that land, they can't go to the bank and raise capital on what is a legitimate wealth that is sitting there. I think white people over history, and maybe that comes out of our history as well, have been more inclined to be homeowners. The unintended consequence of that is wealth accumulates over a period of time to people who have access to finance,
and can make that finance work where inflation and growth outstrips the charges on the finance costs. So if it's possible to finance an asset that will appreciate in time, and you can have access to finance, and your growth is higher than that financing cost, you will create enormous wealth over time. And if you if you disqualify a large group of our population and discourage them from owning capital, specifically own ownership, the unfortunate consequence is they might have a plot and a field to return to, but they will never be wealthy enough to perhaps look after their families in the way they could have if they had title deed and they have access to own ownership. So perhaps let me just leave it at there. It is a broad topic and it speaks to the heart of transformation.
I thought that this was a typographical error. You meant nationalization instead of normalization.
I'm unfortunately older than 35, so I can't speak on that bill. The ownership at group level, Chair, is our focus is very much we have to report that number because that's how it's reflected on the JSE in terms of our traded shares. But our focus is very much at the operational level. So we've got our eye very much on the 26% and the 26% and the 27% at the bottom. And we're looking for opportunities how we can grow that at that operational level over time with the full understanding that it's just a matter of adding up and the top number will change over time. So our SETs, because of our model perhaps being biased towards the Bafokeng model, it's not one that's empowerment at the top level. It is really, because that's the field where entrepreneurs are very efficient. We like to empower it at the operational level where if you have equity, we expect to see you in the board meeting. We expect to see you there when we meet and discuss operational issues, and we want to hear your answers to solutions that we're dealing with on a day-to-day basis. That's the only model that we believe is workable and really empowers the partners to a large degree. Having equity in your bottom right-hand drawer and just waiting for the dividends on a monthly basis is a form of empowerment, and there's a place for it, certainly. But, you know, and as much, I'm not saying that we will discount it, but it's not our favorite approach. Our approach is more at can we push it at the operational level a little bit further. On the Marula slide, the employment equity, the B that you referred to, it's just a transcribe of the DMR's table, which actually means, if I remember right, adding certain columns. So the subtotal A will be everything to the left of the A. So it will be the African male, African female, colored female, Indian female, white female. And that's subtotal I, and then the grand total is B, and then Dave could just say you've got to divide the one by the other one to give a percentage that you have to report on your scorecard. So it just comes from their scorecard. I think on women representation you make a very important point. And I'd like to assure the committee that if you sit in our monthly meetings where we reflect on our progress and how we're doing, you will see that we report these numbers without white females. So when we think about transformation and when we report these numbers, we discount white females. We don't consider white females at this stage to be an empowerment effort. Because if you look at their percentage relative to their demographic in South Africa, you can make an argument that transformation has happened, that they are represented in the organization at the level in which they are in society. So for us, it's pushing the others that are still below. So the reason why we include them for this presentation is under the mining charter, somehow they still reflect it as an empowerment category and something that we need to just reflect on and talk to you. But let me assure you, if you've got the National Union of Mine Workers as an 80% plus constituent, they very much have their eye on that practice. And I think you are right, there are certainly some companies that have looked at the availability of females, and white females are more available in the job market than black females, and have used it as an easy way of pushing the numbers up. But it's certainly not our intention or our strategy, rest assured about that. Tali, can I hand over to you on the housing?
I think maybe what I would like to do is that maybe when
Can you handle, were you here when the question was raised about labor sending hearing?
About the plowing.
The tractors and all, were you here? Okay. Yes.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, we have started with cooperatives within our essential oils project, where we took 40 families that gave us land to start the project, and then they are the co-owners of this project. So it's doing very well, and we are also in the process of putting up a trust for them. So we are definitely in that line of cooperatives.
Maybe I can just add, I think it is a viable model and something that we can look at. I think for mining companies, where we would have a concern is what happens to those tractors once we leave them there. So if we can get the necessary assurances from the local agricultural departments and the cooperatives that it is sustainable, they will be maintained, they will still be there, they will be used in the broad area as they should, it would be an easy project to support.
I think just to add a little bit there, yes, if honorable member, you look at the amount in terms of capital investment which we put there, the pivots and all those, and that project, just the capital investment in terms of plant and equipment, was 5.4 million on that, which is a huge amount, but usually I've got a separate agreement with them, which I don't show my seniors, which says they will never sell that those plants or equipment without Impala's approval, and all, even if we have left the project. So what you don't want is to leave the project after you go there, after a year, everything has been sold. So we have got those agreements. Just to come on the housing, a quick one. Honorable Chairman, it's not really to segregate the employees in terms of, let me start with the graduates. The issue is that you have the intention of the company is to recruit graduates from the university so that you put them in the stream, they can sort of pick up from there within the company. Because what I've said, if you look in terms of the HDSA now in South Africa, especially in the platinum industry, we are more notorious of buying the cake than baking the cake. Everybody wants to buy the ready-made one. Nobody wants to cook them from the beginning. And what happens now with these youngsters, they are more demanding. They said, if you recruit me, I need accommodation, decent accommodation. And looking also at their salaries, you want to accommodate them within their salaries. The issue I can tell you now, if I can open that for everybody, it will be flooded by the guys who can afford because it's cheaper there to stay there. They cook for them and all those things. So that's the only thing. We don't want people who can afford, like Dali, going there because it's cheaper and say, I'll stay here. In terms of the critical skills of the houses which we own as a company, again, it goes back to the issue that we recruit a guy from Enron, for example. This guy said, I'm having a house here in Rustenburg. You know it's very difficult to get houses here. If you don't give me a house, I'm not coming to you. So then, sort of, we reserve those. And if we don't have that, I can tell you, in terms of our employment equity stats, they will plummet because employees will categorically refuse to come if they cannot be accommodated, and that's a skill which you need for your business. So that's basically the reason. And in terms of the ownership, I think Honorable Lady have asked a question of Vanishton. The member was sitting in front of me. But in terms of ownership, how we have structured the ownership of these guys, as I've said, it's normal, they have got bonds, yes, over those houses. But what we usually do, there's an insurance also which we have negotiated that this guy will be allowed, if he is, for example, retrenched, he will be allowed to look for a job for a period of 6 months. So the insurance covering the bond repayment. then if you cannot sort of sell it within 6 months or cannot get employment, then the owners is appointed based on the individual whether he sell the house at the 330, having that equity of 65, and see what to do about it, or make different arrangement. But our intention is not to say when the guy leaves the company. We have 15 people who have left, by the way, in that project. We don't say, if you leave us, then you give us our house back. So even if it goes to the competitor, we allow him to raise finance, sort of in a different format from ours, so that he can still own his house. Because as a company, we have taken an initiative where we say, housing should not be a competitive edge. We should not compete about housing and say, I'll provide decent housing. So we have seen also a lot of mining companies and non-mining companies who have visited us sort of to replicate the model, which we have given them the facts. You would see it probably coming soon within the gold mines. We said, it's because it's not a competitive edge. So we give them so that they can assist their employees. Thank you.
Honorable Chair, there's just one last question that you specifically asked. It's the last question on my list here. It's the one about the contribution to job creation. I think it's important for the community to understand that there's two ways that as a company we interact in terms of job creation. The one is imparting skills, using our training facilities and our ability to bring youngsters in and give them the ability to access the job market. But if we don't grow as a company, we don't create extra job opportunities that we can then offer them. So what we're saying is traditionally companies' approach has been to train just enough to fill their own requirements. We've moved beyond that, and perhaps I should have put that one initiative a little bit different, the one of 140. It's 140 per month. What we're trying to do there is give 1,500 people access to the mining job market who would not normally have had access per year. Of that, I need, or the company needs to grow at a substantial rate to be able to absorb them into our business. But even if we don't, they will be available to the larger job market. And I also know that some of the skills that we employ on the mine, these employees are getting older, and the turnover rates will increase, and there will be a place for these people to go to. So I think one very important area in which we interact is to train beyond our own needs, to go the extra mile, to equip people for the job market. Over the last 10 years, Impala has grown at an annualized rate of 4% per year, which means the jobs in Impala, the 60,000 odd jobs, will also grow at 4% per year going on. Now that's higher than our GDP in South Africa. Over the last couple of years, it slowed down, and we think that in the next 3 years or so, we'll grow at 3% per year. Now, that is still a meaningful growth rate. I still think it's a little bit more than the national average. Now, mining is supposed to be a sunset industry without any growth. So for us to sustain 4% and look like 3% moving forward, I think it's still a very, very good achievement and will create a lot of jobs. The one that we have on our horizon is Leeukop. If we can get the project to work, if we can get it past our board, and remember it's going to be a very significant capital requirement, it's going to take 10 years to complete, but it will create 5,000 direct jobs, and it will create a lot of other jobs in the process of developing this project. I think where perhaps we need assistance from this committee and from government is understanding what are the issues that's allowing us to grow at 3%. You know, what would it take for Impala to grow at 5% or 6% or 7%? I don't think as an industry and as an organization we have clear answers to that question. I think we have some thoughts around that. Transformation is certainly not one of them. It is certainly something that you push up growth, not push it down. But perhaps something that we can explore a bit more robustly, because anything that we can do that will change our business environment so that we can grow at a faster rate will create the kind of jobs that I think we need as a country to put people off the streets and into decent jobs. I thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's, honourable members, let's thank Impala for the very detailed presentation and the engagement that we have had with them. And indeed, we will study your information further. And if there's anything else, we would get back to you. But so far, for now, we have dealt with all the issues. Suffice to say this, that both for you and the previous presenters and those that are still going to present, on the area of job creation into the future, you know, we have been looking for bold commitments. For instance, mining companies are avoiding to talk to the implementation of their rehabilitation programs, which in any event should run concurrently with your mining process. There are jobs that could be created there. There are commitments that you have made to the department when you applied for licenses that you would set aside certain sums of money, and those funds are accumulating, let alone those that have not fulfilled those commitments that they have made. The second area is you are sitting on quite a large number of mine dumps that could be, you know, put into good use in terms of tailing, and in that process, jobs can be created. But I don't know what is this difficulty that mining companies don't want to make that commitment up front and offer those dumps for that purpose, for them to can be able to then deal with. So I'm saying there are various initiatives that could be taken which could speak to these numbers. For instance, the issue of beneficiation. You know, if mining companies could make the upfront commitment in terms of beneficiation, we see here that you are doing beneficiation, you are running smelters, and which is quite an opposable kind of an action. And if we could expand in that area, because already we are talking of you know, beneficiating almost all our mineral commodities within the country and moving away from exporting our raw materials, and which has been the traditional way of doing business in the country. For instance, some of the mines have had rail infrastructure built between their mining operations and the port, which means that the intention and the purpose was from original to simply excavate, put it on the transport, off it goes, you know, to the sea. So we want a paradigm shift in as far as that is concerned. So these are the areas that we're trying to nudge mining industry to basically take end of government in terms of finding, you know, the spaces for job creation. But we're not going to hold you to that, because it's amazing how evasive a number of you know, mining companies are that have presented so far in terms of these tangible commitments that we are looking for. But in terms of your transformation record, it's quite impressive. I want to join those that have congratulated you. Thank you very much. Honorable members, I don't know if you would want to stick it out, we clean out, we mop up those that are remaining, or you would want to take lunch. I'm in your hands. Yes. You want to take lunch. You want us to mop them up. What are the other views? This is your time, so you will have to decide.
Mr. Chair, why don't we just take a 15-minute adjournment and come back?
Take a
15-minute adjournment.
And come back.
I personally just need to go do something in the office. I need to go. So I need to run there and come back, but otherwise, I'm in your hands.
Okay, why don't we take 30 minutes to accommodate both views? Please, lunch should not be longer than 30 minutes, and we come back and we deal with them. What time is it now? It's 22. Is that so? 22. Can we be back here at 10 past 2? 10 past 2. Yeah. If you need a lift, we'll carry you. Yeah, okay. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned for now.